We have the technology, and it's working, and it's cost-effective. It's back to the subject of energy and the business case for renewable energy today. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The Seward Sea Life Center is drawing its energy from the ocean, thermal energy, solar energy. Our phone number statewide, toll-free, 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage, 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. The potential of the ocean as a solar energy collector for Alaska, the subject today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Before we head down to Seward, I think we'll start in Anchorage. The subject is solar energy, however, especially solar energy from the ocean. But let's start with the solar tour, because Andy Baker, energy consultant with Your Clean Energy, is with us and in charge of the solar tour. Andy, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, thanks for having us.
So, the solar tour. I know there's an office building downtown with solar panels along the front of it. I'm trying to think if I've seen anything else.
Well, this
could be a really short tour.
Not really. It's actually a lot of systems that have gone in the last 6 years, I'd say. And so the solar tour is a chance for the public, anyone, to come out and visit. There are six sites at different times, and there's a schedule. It starts at 10 a.m., goes until 4 o'clock.
Okay, and we're talking, June 7th?
Yeah, June 7th. And there's a schedule on alaskasolartour.org. on there, and we start downtown at the solar building at 10 o'clock, and that's the big, we call it the Great Wall of Solar. It's on the south face of the building on Fifth Avenue, and that's all photovoltaics. But the other sites all are combinations of solar hot water systems, passive solar, and also solar PV, and they're a mix of commercial and residential buildings. So if you're interested in learning about solar, or you're an installer or an engineer or architect, these are great examples. These are some of the best we have in Anchorage that are up there.
I remember being really shocked. I think my first trip to Hawaii, discovering that people routinely were heating their household hot water with the sun. And I thought, well, it's Hawaii. I guess that makes sense. But Alaska? I mean, it seems like we have limitations, a bad sun angle, and big seasonal fluctuations. Seems like is this really practical?
Well, that's a great question. A lot of people have that opinion. We get about the same solar gain as Seattle, Washington, because they're quite overcast. So we get about an average of three noon sun hours a day. That's like being at the equator for 3 hours at noon. That's over the year. We get about 70% of the solar energy in 7 months. So the trick here is, if you aim your collectors true south and you tilt them at latitude, which is 60 degrees, you can't do any better than that. And if you do that, you can come up with about 50 to 60% of your domestic hot water for solar hot water collection. And you can come up with 10 to 20% of your electricity for a building, depending on the roof space that you have.
Wow. Has this technology markedly improved in, say, the last 10 years?
It has. It really has. Today we're talking most about making heat with the sun. There's, of course, making electricity, the PV we were talking earlier. The panels today for electricity will produce up to 22% of the sun that hits it will be converted to wire for the best panels. On the solar hot water side, that's also improved. We're up to about 60 to 70% in Alaska of the sun that hits your collector will be converted to heat. And we take a bit of a hit in the winter months, and that's particularly between November 15th and about the 1st of February. However, we have this other amazing thing working for us. It's called snow. And albedo. So if you get at least 30 feet of fresh snow in front of a collector, you can get up to 25% more gain from that orientation at that time. And we see this. We have one of the sites on the tour is Seth Downs Solar Hot Water. It's a triplex with six collectors for solar hot water. And there's an elementary school across the street. When the sun hits that snow field, the collectors go crazy and they ramp up. And so using your yard in front or lake or even your neighbor's flat roof as a collector is a way to improve the gain.
This is really nutsy boltsy. This is great. This is the kind of thing Alaskans love to talk about. We've got Andy Baker of Your Clean Energy with us. He's running the solar tour. How many years has it been going now?
This is the fifth annual tour.
Uh-huh. And it's just in Anchorage. Are there equivalent anywhere else in the state?
Yes, there are, and it varies year to year. Anchorage, we've consistently had it for the last 5 years. The Mattsu Valley's had a tour, and I believe theirs will be in the fall this year. Kenai's had one, Homer's had one, Fairbanks. It depends on the organizer, and they've had some turnover there. This kind of all started in 2008. I took a trip down to Boulder, Colorado, to the American Solar Energy Society and visited with them and asked them how we could get Alaska on the map for the National Solar Tour. And they told us how to do it, and then we had organizers in the different cities, and it sort of took off from there. And I've worked really hard to keep this one going because it's really motivating people to do new things. And we have some really innovative people, and for architects and just the average person, it's just a really cool day to go out and see all this stuff.
So it's not necessarily a user. I mean, it might just be a fan that wants to see this stuff, huh?
Yeah, we get young people, young couples who just bought a house or thinking about it. Then we get middle-aged folks who've been thinking about solar for too long, and then we get a lot of retired people who are really excited about it. A lot of times they don't quite have the extra cash to do these systems. But we're most interested, actually, in the younger folks as far as getting exposure to them because they're going to be the ones who see possibility in these systems, and they may become building owners, designers. They get really excited. If it's a sunny day, there's nothing like seeing the systems working because it's the real thing.
So do you have any good passive in here? I mean, that would seem to be just the simple thermal energy of the sun and the gain and being able to retain it and use it would seem to be your biggest one.
It is. Putting your windows in, south-facing windows are the lowest cost way to get solar gain. There's one house on here that was built precisely for the solar resource in Anchorage. It's called the Kittleson House. It's the fourth site. And so it's facing south. The roof was sloped right at 60 degrees. And they get so much sun coming in there passively that the house will it stays warm any sunny day through the winter, and they get great gain off the panels.
Direct that air around? Because the one passive building that I had experience with, it all collected right there in the atrium, and you need to move that air. It would get really hot in there.
Yeah, they have ventilation, and the other secret, too, is radiant floor. If you put a big thermal mass of concrete in your floor, that'll soak up extra heat in the room and hold on to it. And so that's another part of it, and along with insulation and other building envelope features. I mean, we're not just interested in the passive or active solar, but the whole building envelope. And so a lot of these folks have done a lot of work on the buildings or designed them properly for that, and then they put the solar on, so it really works well.
Wendy, when you came around and pitched the solar tour, you said, "And wait till you hear about this thing in Seward." And I couldn't. I mean, it's still blowing my mind. And so I'm very happy that Daryl Schaefermeyer was driven all the way up here from the Seward Sea Life Center. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And you're the facilities director, right?
That's correct.
And maybe you can give me a little sketch of what it is that you're doing with the ocean's energy at the Sea Life Center.
Well, we're taking the water that we pump in every day for our life support systems.
So you already had to have that because
it's important. We already have that. We pump literally millions of gallons a day of seawater through the building. We have a ready source. So we're taking that and we're converting some of that energy that's in that seawater. And believe it or not, there's a lot of energy in seawater. And we take that, right now it's running in about 42 degrees Fahrenheit. We take that through a heat exchanger and take it across and pump it down to some large heat pumps that then convert that into 120 degree energy. And then we supply that to various parts in our building. So we have a mini district heating system basically in our building using some of that seawater heat energy.
So this is kind of like a situation very similar really to a boiler.
That's correct.
Except that it's just coming off the heat exchanger.
We're using the heat exchangers to take that energy and then boosting it up with heat pumps.
Yeah. Well, also with us and joining us by cell phone from Hawaii, where he now lives, Tom Royer, Professor Emeritus of Oceanography at the University of Alaska. Tom, welcome to Talk of Alaska. How are you doing today in Hawaii?
Thank you. Very, very well. Temperatures here are summer-like, right?
Yeah, it's we're, of course, in South Central Alaska, extremely relieved today because it's raining, and we've had this really, really bad fire down on the Kenai Peninsula, so everybody's like, whew, man, very, very happy. So, Tom.
Yeah, that's good news.
Yeah, very much so. Tom, for those who don't know, Tom is the person who saw to it that the Seward Line was installed. This is a very, very important oceanographic resource that Alaska has now had for quite a large number of years, which simply consists of a line of moorings that go out into the ocean to tell you what's happening in the ocean. And Tom, through this Seward line and other devices, you're the guy, I guess, that has figured out why the water in Resurrection Bay, where Daryl is getting his water intake, why that water is so warm.
Yeah, right. We looked at it for a number of years, and they have finally figured it out, we think. It's really, I have to step back and look at sort of a global heat engine. Most of the solar energy that strikes the Earth enters either the ocean or the atmosphere at low latitudes, and somehow it has to get up to high latitudes. And we're fortunate that Seward is in line where it receives this energy that's actually started down there in the equator. And that I think that most people are familiar with what happens in the North Atlantic, where the Gulf Stream carries water, warm water from the tropics up to along the east coast of the U.S., and then it moves across the North Atlantic and actually warms Europe.
It goes way north. You know, I've been out in Cornwall and been amazed, you know, to see palm trees. I now know the palm trees are hardy enough to live there anyway, but very tropical-looking vegetation all the way out at the Cornish tip of the British Isles, where you would never expect such a thing, and that's directly the warming in the Gulf Stream, just going all the way up there. So what do we have on the Alaska? We have an equivalent of that somehow?
It's a little more complicated. What we have in the Pacific is we have a similar current to the Gulf Stream. It's called the Kuroshio, and that comes up along Japan, and then it comes across the North Pacific eastward until it strikes North America.
Would this be the same current that has been carrying the tsunami debris?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. but when it gets to the west coast, somewhere offshore of Seattle, it'll split into what we call the California Current and the northward flowing Alaska Current. But and it brings warm water up into the Gulf of Alaska.
So it just goes right along the coast up the southeast and then along the coast to the Gulf of Alaska. And then there's all those inlets there on the outer coast of the Kenai Peninsula, I guess.
Actually, though, the Alaska Current doesn't go along the coast. The Alaska Current goes along the shelf break, which is about 100 miles off the coast. There's a continental shelf that goes offshore, and then it goes into the deep Gulf of Alaska. And the Alaska Current moves along that shelf break. There is an Alaska Coastal Current that's much smaller, and it's not transporting as much warm water as the Alaska Current.
I see. All right. So here's this warm water, but that, and you just told me it's some miles off from Resurrection Bay. So what happens?
Right. Okay. What happens is, of course, we all know that it rains a lot over the Gulf of Alaska and in the coastal areas. What happens is that the fresh water that's accumulated there runs offshore, and as it runs offshore, this upper layer, this very low density, fairly low density water moving offshore, mixes with the water just beneath it and pulls that water off with it, and that water is replaced by some deeper water, and it's that deeper water that has the high temperatures in it, relatively high temperatures.
And so, as I understand it, you can actually see sometimes steaming in Resurrection Bay in the wintertime because of this.
Quite often.
Really?
No. The source of the heat that's being used in the heat exchange process is down about I think the intake is 275 meters.
275 feet. Yes, that's correct.
About 275 feet. Sorry. Yes. But the heat that you see coming off the surface is just from that heat that's evected by the surface currents from lower latitudes. So the Alaska Coastal Current and the Alaska Current will transport heat from lower latitudes, but it's the important, the highest temperatures are actually at depth. It's this warm water that's beneath this freshwater lid that's over the Gulf of Alaska.
Which, you know, it's completely counterintuitive, but it's how it works, right? Because it's something about the density of it.
Right. It's warm, which means lower density, but it's also saltier. So it's high. It relative to the surface, it's a higher density than that fresh water, what I call a lid that's on top of it. And as I think Daryl said, that the temperatures are somewhere in the 40s. They very seldom get down into the 30s. Whereas in Resurrection Bay at the surface, it can get down to something in on the order of 35, 36 degrees, sometimes even freezing at the surface. But this deep water, it remains constant, and actually is a maximum in October and November.
Do we have any numbers on all of this? I mean, like the actual like amount of energy we're dealing with here that is being collected by the ocean that can be harvested?
Well, that's a good question. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, the problem is we don't have the enough measurements to calculate that. Because mm-hmm. you need both a temperature gradient and a currents, and we haven't resolved those parameters sufficiently yet.
But we're talking a colossal amount of energy.
Pardon?
We're talking a colossal amount of energy.
Oh yeah, Yeah, I think the amount of energy that the Sea Life Center is pulling out is insignificant compared to the source.
And yet, it's of such a scale, Darryl, as I understand, that there's a possibility of even sharing it around in downtown.
Exactly. We're looking right now at doing some feasibility work to set up a plan to do district heating in Seward to actually heat much of the community as possible with that energy. We have very high energy costs down there with heating oil. We don't have natural gas. And so people pay a lot of money for their annual heating bill. And we see this as a possibility for lowering that cost and yet tap that immense amount of potential in Resurrection Bay to supply that heat.
So you could theoretically, because you have a kind of a building concentration in the downtown area, you could theoretically get everything piped together in some manner?
Seward's very ideal, and it's city proper for doing that, because we're laid out on a street grid that lends itself to doing just that. Of course, we're right next to the bay, and that's a good place to demonstrate this technology.
Tom Royer, is anything you want to add? I don't want to keep you too long here with that phone connection.
There was a misconception about what's going on in the Seward line, but
go ahead and clear it up.
We don't have moorings out there. We just have one mooring at the present time, and that's at the mouth of Resurrection Bay. And we would like to put some moorings out, but of course there's the money limitation and the manpower. But we go out on ships and do profiles and measure various parameters, and we've expanded the line in the last 17 years to include biology along with the physics. It's temperature and salinity measurements and currents.
So it's just basically a set of coordinates, and then you just make sure you revisit it.
Yeah, I claim I live at the end of the Seward line.
The end of the Seward line. All right.
Southern end on Maui.
Right. Tom Royer, thank you so much for being with us on the show. Look forward to seeing you next time you're back in Alaska, which happens quite frequently.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Yeah, we got a call from Rand in Galena. And, of course, we all know Galena is flood devastated. Rand, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Steve, always a pleasure to visit with you and let you know what we got going on here in Galena.
Well, I like getting these updates.
Yeah. We were devastated. There's no question about that. But, you know, out of that, some good is arising. Not so much out of the ashes, but up out of the muck. A lot of the rebuilding that we're doing here, we've teamed up with CCHRC. We have a solar project that the city and the school are working on together. We installed a number of panels 18 months ago. We're going to work on finishing that up. So we're exploring our solar options and finding that about a two-year payback on the project that we did. So we're looking at other conservation measures from high-efficiency generators, building envelopes with more insulation. Some of the designs on the new homes that we're rebuilding from the homes that were destroyed, they're finding that they can heat their home the entire winter on what the cost was for 1 month before. So we're implementing some conservation measures and doing things out here to try to become much more self-reliant and independent, if you will. And they can't raise the price on that sunshine, so that's a constant, you know. They haven't figured out a way to tax it. So,
tell me a little bit more about what kind of solar technology you've got.
Well, we've got solar panels. We put up a solar photovoltaic. It's what we did, and there are 24 panels, and we have another phase to put up. It's fairly small. You know, we're talking a little under 7 kilowatts. It's data collection and takes care of a building or two here, but the whole purpose of it was to put it up and test it and see if we could do it and operate it and so forth. And the beauty of it is that once it's up and in place, you know, there's very little very little maintenance on something like that as far as the moving parts and stuff go. And I'm a strong advocate of it because, you know, as I say, you know, once you have the capital costs laid out and have the projects put in, your operating costs are very, very low. There are some challenges with how much of that solar energy you can put into your systems as they exist and so forth, but mostly photovoltaic is what we've done and what we explored, but we're looking at, I'm excited to hear some of the other things you're talking about, especially heat pumps and so forth, because as you know, underneath the permafrost, the temperature of the ground is pretty constant, and I've often said, why don't we pump in 45 degree air into the buildings and then heat it the rest of the way when it's 45 below outside. So those are concepts that I think have a lot of value and have a lot of potential as the prices of oil go up. I think we're kind of falsely lured into a sense that everything's going to be okay with the Bakken oil field, but as we watch our oil reserves diminish here in Alaska, I think it's incumbent on us to become more conservative and lean towards some of these other technologies that I'm hearing about, and I'm excited to hear what they're doing down in Seward. I think that's wonderful.
Andy, you got any questions there for Rand?
Are you doing anything with the solar hot water heating? Is that an option you're looking at?
We've got a couple of little test module type things we're working on now. We're working with not water at this point, but I don't know if you've heard of Can Solar, where they take the cans and build the Air Force that just heat during the day with pop cans. It's an outfit out of Quebec that uses those, and they have them covered with plastic, and it's just you know, the convection of the air heating up models that pump hot air in. So just a few of those that we're kind of experimenting with, but we haven't done much with the hot water, but I think it's got to be the next phase. We're a school, so most of the summertime, you know, we're fairly shut down, but as you look for other uses of buildings and ways to operate them, the cost of heating fuel and for just heating water is cost prohibitive out here. So I think it's a natural progression that we'll probably go to in the not-too-distant future.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about that heat pump technology. It seems to me that probably the technology that you're talking about already exists somewhere.
Yeah, it does. It's just a matter of, with everything else, it's the capital outlay, you know. It's so hard to get over that sticker shock. But when you start looking at the return, you know, like I say, we have folks that have built these new houses up here that in 1 month, you know, they'll pay for their fuel for the rest of the year, just what they're saving on their cost savings. So
yeah,
I think that's important.
Rand, thanks so much for the update coming from Galena there.
Hey, we're back at it. Keep moving forward and stay calm.
All right. Thank you. Glad you're staying in touch. So, Daryl, how much is Sea Life Center saving with this heating scheme?
Well, since 2013, we've saved approximately 60% of our heating cost. In other words, we've been able to generate about 60% of our annual heating requirement for the facility using our seawater heat pump system.
Wow.
It's in 2013 that averaged almost $10,000 a month in actual saving cost.
Well, the first thing that comes, I should give out the phone number 1-800-478-8255 to join our conversation. We're talking about solar energy, and in particular from the ocean, but also from the ground. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage is 550-8422. Email us talk@alaskapublic.org. And we have Daryl Schaefermeyer of the Alaska Sea Life Center and Andy Baker of Your Clean Energy with us on the show today, exploring these energy issues. One thing that comes to mind about using seawater and heat exchangers is fouling.
That's something you have to take into account with your design. You do that by getting titanium plate heat exchangers. We put a lot of attention and did a lot of research in heat exchangers before we selected one to use, and we've been very happy with the heat exchanger that we installed. It's working very well. We also have periods of time during the year we get silt in Resurrection Bay due to the stream runoff, storm runoff, and so we also have to pay attention to that, and we were able to deal with that by putting in a strainer system that helps us control that during the periods. of storm runoff.
You make it sound so simple.
Well, actually, it's not that complicated. We actually installed and built this system within our building using our own personnel. And so it does take a little bit of skill, and certainly we have some very talented individuals that work at the Sea Life Center. We handle a lot of water and a lot of piping, and we were able to do all of that with our own staff, and it works very well.
So tell me more about the heat pump and how it works.
Well, maybe have Andy help me there a little bit with this,
right,
because it does get into some technology, but it's pretty simple. Works very similar to your refrigerator in your home, only in this case we're not cooling down a compartment. We're providing the heat that process generates, and we bring in the seawater at the 42 degree temperature that it is right now. We exchange it across in a heat exchanger to another fluid that's about a 10% glycol and water solution. We pipe that down to some large, what we call 90-ton heat exchangers. We have two of those. They work by a refrigerant that boils at a low temperature. So that 40-degree temperature hits that refrigerant. It causes it to boil, turns it into a vapor. Then that vapor we use inside the heat pumps, compressors that then compress it. When you compress the vapor, it gets very hot. And then it's exchanged across to another heat exchanger inside the heat pumps into water. And that water goes out at 120 degrees, and we send it to preheat our domestic hot water. We send it up to preheat the air coming in for our large air handlers. And then also, very importantly, in the wintertime, we use it to heat our pavement heating system. We use a lot of slab heat, we call it, in our facility, both for keeping ice away from melted off our habitats, our outside research laboratory decks, and some of our public sidewalk heat. We keep the snow melted. And so all of those things are allowing us to provide heat and save energy and save costs at the same time.
Andy, I think he did it. He did explain it.
He did pretty good. One of the things that we look at with the heat pumps that's really kind of the aha moment is what we call the COP, it's coefficient of performance. And it's a real easy way to tell how you're doing with the heat pump. And that's basically the ratio of the energy you get out of the heat pump divided by the energy you put into it. And one of the fundamental things to understand about heat pumps is what you're doing is you're not making heat, you're moving it. So the heat pump is a method to move heat from a lower temperature to a higher temperature. So in the case of the Sea Life Center, what we did there is put these heat pumps in so that two-thirds of the heat that Daryl finally gets out of the system is coming from the ocean. One-third of the energy he's got to put in with pumping and the heat pumps. And so they're running for 2013, they ran an average COP for the year of 2.77. So that's 277% efficiency as compared to straight electric heat. Because with straight electric heat, you put one unit of energy into the heater, you get one unit out. So Daryl's putting one unit of heat into his energy into his heat pump. He's getting 2.77 out of it. And that's because it's coming from the ocean. And that's where that's the real magic of it in terms of economics. You do pay more for electricity because you've got to move those loops, but it's a lot cheaper to move loops of water than to try to make heat with electricity.
All right. I'm going to get back to that and the electric power demand as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Finding the time for physical activity after school, homework, and dinner can be tough, but you can make it a priority to stay healthy as a family. Go for a bike ride, take a walk around the neighborhood, or play a game of basketball with your kids. Get active, get moving, and have fun as a family. Inspire your kids to get out and play 60 minutes every day. For more ways to get physically active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
talking solar energy applications in Alaska, solar energy from the ocean. We have Andy Baker of Your Clean Energy, Daryl Schaefermeyer of the Alaska Sea Life Center with us. And it's been primarily about heat pumps. And the thing with the heat pump is that you have to put power in. You have to put power in to make this magic transfer happen. So the coefficient of a performance is somehow related to how you measure what you're gaining?
Yeah, it's just the ratio of the energy out of the heat pump divided by the energy that you put
very
in.
Very simple,
into
then.
It. Yeah, it's a real... And in fact, at the Sea Life Center, what they've done is they put all of their electrical power through one motor control center, one power panel, and there's one power meter. So that's the energy going into the system, and then they have one BTU meter to measure the heat coming out of the heat pump. We take those two numbers, and there's the system COP for the whole system.
Wow. So you could graph it out pretty much.
Oh, yes. We do it. In fact, our control system that we have graphs it out real time, so you can go on there, you can look at the graph at any moment of time.
So I'm picturing this control room somehow.
Well, no, it's a building automation system is what it is, and it's on the internet basically. You can go on from any computer if you have the passwords and the access, and go on, log on, and any time check and see what the system, how it's performing,
mm-hmm.
and see the COP. So real time.
So as a facilities manager, what percentage of your time is used up with troubleshooting and stuff associated with the heat pump system?
With this system,
yeah.
not very much.
Really?
It's pretty reliable. There's not a whole lot. It took us a while, of course, to build it and to get the control system installed,
right.
and troubleshoot it. But it works pretty well.
So you can you're saying you can even like check it from home?
Yes. Oh yeah, I do it all the time.
Huh.
I can even check it on my smartphone
right now.
Yes, right now.
I hope it doesn't ring, please.
No,
please.
It won't.
Oh, thank you. Very good. You got it under control.
I do.
Yeah. Well, Roger joins the program from Valdez. Roger, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Roger of Valdez.
Hey,
hi.
Roger. Hey, I just came across a program on the television. I forget which channel, but it's called Living on the Edge, and it shows a lot of different examples of what people are doing. I guess pretty much living off the grid, either that or living in combination with the grid. And well, I guess it's all the things a person would learn if they were to read Mother Earth news, or there's all sorts of information out there about how people can get away from this standardized petrol-based heating and energy and all that. And
yeah, and Andy's eyes are lighting up as you speak.
Yeah, you know, we're just kind of trapped in this standardized situation, and people be like, well, we're doing it because it's the way it's always been done, and it's just sort of a trap we're in. And yeah, it's nice to hear about people who come up with these individualized solutions, and I'm really interested in these individual solutions. But I, you know, we're all tied into this big electric grid, and the main sources of power go into our power lines. I mean, it's set up so that it's set up to have one main power source, and then that power source is distributed to all the consumers, and then some corporation, I guess, rakes in a lot of money because so many consumers times X amount of dollars, and it all adds up, and so there's a lot of...
Well, that's changing. I mean, the regulatory environment is not really allowing that anymore. It's going to take some time, I think, but it's
I've
changing.
I've been following that a little bit about the Fire Island wind energy, and it doesn't seem like that's being embraced with open arms, and I just can't quite understand that one. Because, you know...
Well, I mean, we could do a whole show on that. I mean, it has to do with load. You know, you get load at times when you don't need it, and you still have to be prepared for peaks and all that sort of thing. So from an engineer's point of view, that you know, they don't see it as the greatest thing.
Yeah, it's anyway, that program on the TV is called Living on the Edge, and I just started watching it, and there's all these different solutions to run your home very efficiently. I'm just going to give one example here in Valdez. Is back in the early 80s, they jammed a bunch of trailers into this town for all the workers who were building the terminal. And all these trailers are still sitting here. It's like a mobile home. Okay, you jam it in there. It's got a forced air heater. And so you pop in your diesel fuel and you're blowing air around this trailer, and all the windows and the insulation's all moldy and wet, and all this you know, it costs all this money to heat your trailer. I went over to a Toyo stove finally, but you know, there's still a lot of people living like that with these old style mobile homes with the forced air blower just blowing this hot air around these old moldy vents coming, and all the insulation's inefficient, and you know, a lot of the world's set up like that. It's just this real inefficiency, but whoever controls the oil and the power source, I mean, they're not squawking about it because they're making a lot of money. They don't care if you're efficient or not efficient. They just care about they're making a lot of money selling that electricity.
Yeah, well, I think you're, you know, Valdez is kind of a special case because your housing stock is, you got a real housing stock problem there, including the problem with your mobile homes. But I mean,
all across the country, there's all sorts of inefficiencies going on, and people just get stuck in it and they can't quite get out of it.
Yeah.
So I'm starting to explore more alternatives, and I'm glad that the Seward is trying this out, and there's a lot of things out there that are being tried out.
Well, I'd say it's more than trying it out. It's working for the Sea Life Center. It's a question of whether it gets expanded, and it's going to take feasibility work to do that. Thanks, Roger, for your call.
I'll make one last comment. I'll tell you, these power companies that are raking in all this money selling electricity, they're not going to get too excited about these alternative possibilities. That's just my final thought on that.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. Sometimes we got co-ops, though. That's true, too.
Well, there's also, in the case of Seward, that is a city electric, a city utility. Right. And there was a presentation this week down there on district heating. And one of the concepts was the possibility of a city-owned district heating system. And that, you know, and Daryl can speak to this more, but the general consensus there was that the cost of heat there has become so high that, you know, businesses are shuttering in the winter and they're paying huge bills the rest of the time. They don't have access to natural gas that could only be trucked in. And so in their case, the risk of doing nothing may be their greatest risk. And so with the Sea Life Center economics that we see, the idea of pumping that loop of water around a dense area of buildings where you'd have economy of scale, and then each building lifting with the heat pump inside the building offers them the possibility of reducing their heat costs significantly, and that heating system would be theirs using their own resource. And that was an idea that really struck folks hard at that meeting. I think they really took to that. Daryl could speak to more about that.
I mean, that's what in part got me interested in doing this. I wanted to improve our costs at the Sea Life Center, certainly, but we were able to see pretty early on that this could work for the city of Seward, and I think that's our next vision now, is to see if we can make that happen.
Yeah. So an actual municipal, I mean, that would be. That used to be somewhat common, I guess, in some American cities, but the idea that that it's an actual municipal facility—that's that's socialism.
Well, it's in the case of Seward, Seward has long operated its own utilities.
Yeah.
We operate water and sewer. We have, as well as the electric system, and it makes sense. Maybe not for all places, but it works in a lot of the coastal communities.
So how long have you been the facilities director there?
Well, I've actually had a number of titles, but I've been with the Sea Life Center since the very beginning. I was involved with it from its formative days and throughout, so over 20 years.
So you started out when it was just an idea.
Yeah, just an idea, exactly.
And now you've kind of gone into where you associate with the hardware end of the business.
Well, I've always been in the hardware end of the business down there in to a degree, but more so now.
Yeah. Well, it's a remarkable resource just on its own, without the energy part of it.
Well, that's true. We do some very exciting stuff there, and it's a great place for people to come. And we put research on display. We do some things that typically you don't do at a lot of public aquariums throughout the country.
Yeah. 1-800-478-8255, the telephone number, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talkatalaskapublic.org, and we'll get back with some of the other elements of the solar tour as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce. From healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants, Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking energy yet one more time. Ben joins the program from NOATAC. Ben. Oh, Ben's not actually queued up yet. Okay, well, let me go to this. Andy Baker, how did you get involved in this energy business?
Well, I was a civil engineering consultant, graduated from Penn State, and I worked on municipal water systems for about 15 years. I worked for Black & Veatch, a big company in San Diego, Boston, and I was overseas for 5 years. I came to Alaska in 1998, worked for HDR Alaska for 3 years, and I got really interested in clean energy as a really in a deeper sense. I've always felt, I guess in the last 10 years, that we need to find some other solutions. And so in 2006, I went solo, started a company called Your Clean Energy, and I really had no idea what the market was in Alaska. Because here we are in the oil state of Alaska. I'm downtown. There's the ConocoPhillips building, the BP.
Yeah.
And so, you know, is there really people that care about this and so forth? And what am I going to do? So I had a lot of experience in pumping water, and I knew a bit about thermodynamics. And so I started working on solar hot water systems, which do work really well here. And that led me eventually to heat pumps. And I started working with Daryl in 2008 because they had the $5 a gallon year in Seward with heating oil and just about crushed the budget for that facility. And one of their employees had read about this system in Japan that used seawater for heating. So they asked me to help him out with an evaluation. And I threw myself into that, and when you start crunching the numbers and looking at the simplicity of the heat pump systems, that really struck me, and I kind of was drawn into that that element of it. And so now most of my work is in heat pumps, and I think that's really going to be the future. And my work has also started out with the smaller systems, and of course you want to get bigger. And, you know, the idea of taking a large building off fossil fuels forever is now possible with the Sea Life Center. But then the next step would be a group of buildings or perhaps a downtown. And then you get into this district heating, and that's kind of the direction I'm heading in now and the economics of that kind of system.
So, I kind of had you pegged as a guy that's into the business case part of it, the economic part of it, but actually, yeah, the business plan part of it, but actually, you're in the engineering side of it. You like those nuts and bolts, too.
Well, I do, but I think it's both. I think it's, you know, it's like if you talk to people who work for utility companies, it's got to be affordable, reliable, safe. And that's the motto of the business plan that I have for all my clients. And it's hard to do all three. And so there's also the environmental element, which is the emissions, the liability of pollution from burning organic carbon. And so when you, if you can get off of that, that element, and have a safe, reliable system and earn better returns than fossil fuels, then you're going to get the attention of facilities. And that's, I think that's the tough nut to crack. And it takes a lot of innovation. However, if we look to, for example, Norway, I think, is one of the best countries we can look to because it's a similar climate. They're an oil and gas producer. They have the big coastline. They've got the seawater. They're all over the seawater heat pumps and district heating, for example. And so it's working there. It surely can work here.
Benton. We got Ben connected now down in NOAATAC. Ben, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, good morning. Well, I am part of the, I guess you mentioned the cooperative. I am part of the cooperative, which is AVAC, Alaska Village Electric Cooperative Incorporated. And, you know, the there's always projects going out. I guess there are certain projects going out in some of the small communities. And, it seems that there are always projects going on in larger communities, say, such as Anchorage or Seward or stuff like that. What about an idea of, you know, doing a pilot project maybe in one of the smaller communities just to see what can happen with lowering the cost of energy? See, because my energy bill... Well, I will say this. My energy cost is $195.30. And then they put a fuel cost, which is $377.65. I am paying more for my fuel cost than my energy cost, which is kind of astounding. And, you know, I understand that AVAC has done some pilot projects maybe down in the Kuskokwim area or, you know, in regards to windmill.
It's true,
and
yeah.
I'm wondering what's taking so long for them to go out in other communities, say, such as up here in the north. I know Kotzebue does one, has a windmill project, you know, and what's taking so long for them to go into other communities? You know, it just seems really unfair that the AVAC is ignoring all the other communities and doing projects in certain communities. You know, I mean, come on.
All right, Ben. I'm hearing your complaint. I can't do a damn thing about it, but I'm hearing it. Thanks, Ben. It could be Mira will be listening. Maybe she'll call up and have some ideas. Meanwhile, Andy, you got anything to throw his way as to...
Well, I think the frustration he expresses is very real, and we do have these energy conferences in that every year. There's a rural energy conference, which mm-hmm. is the appropriate one for that, and I've been to those. We presented at that last year, and it, as you know, Steve, a project takes time to evolve, and so we first identify the need, and then there's this sort of teamwork to get to gel around a technology or an idea to do for that. And then there's grant funds, and so we go through that process. And so he sounds like he's ready to take on a project.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, I know AVEC has put a lot of attention into integrating wind energy into the diesel generation. And then also going to a district heating or a situation where they're powering the flywheels, various ways of storing the energy. And probably it's just not, he's pretty right. They just haven't got around to NOAATAC yet. It's probably just about how it is. Chris joins the program from Palmer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Chris. Hi, Chris.
Oh, hi. Hi, thanks for taking the call. And my question for Daryl is why glycol and not ammonia or tetrafluoroethylene, which is sometimes considered better working fluids than glycol? So I'll go off the line for the answer. I'd like to say great job for the Sea Life Center and for Daryl, and standing by for the answer on why not ammonia. Thank you very much.
All right, Chris, thanks.
Good question. We have to be very careful with our environment where we are in the Sea Life Center. We have a lot of animals and things that are very sensitive to the types of fluids and chemicals and things that are used. We chose propylene glycol as it's basically a vegetable grade fluid. It's very friendly. If it gets spilled or otherwise comes into contact with humans or animals, and so that's the reason that we chose the system that we did. You're right. There are other refrigerants. There's other systems that are available, but we chose the environmentally friendly solution.
It's the requirements of the job. Lon, yes. Lon joins the program. Sitka, thank you. Lon, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I work at the Sitka Sound Science Center. I'm the aquaculture director and the facility director here. And much like the Sea Life Center, we've actually been working with Andy Baker to try to get a saltwater-sourced heat pump system put in at the Science Center. And for the very same reasons that the Sea Life Center did it, is makes a huge difference in what our operational costs will be. Right now, we're estimating we spend about $45,000 a year to heat our building, and we think we can, you know, if we get the heat pump system put in, we can bring that down to around $12,000 or $13,000 a year, which is what we spend on electricity now. So we're pretty excited about this. We've been a little bit frustrated that we haven't been able to get grant funds. There's been some Alaska Energy Authority grant funds that we've been trying to get, and so far haven't been successful with that. But we think we have a great opportunity, much like Daryl says there in Seward, being
great.
A great demonstration project for Southeast Alaska anyway.
Lon, thanks a lot for calling from the Sitka Sound Science Center. We are out of time. Andy Baker, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Daryl Schaefer-Meicher.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Dave Waldman, Pat Yak, and I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.